You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
One of the things you know about me, if you've come before, is that I'm a little bit of an internet video junkie, just all the various stories of like Marines coming home to their kids and all that kind of stuff. And so I try to ask myself, why do I love this stuff so much? And so I try to figure out the themes. One theme is that a lot of the videos that I like, a lot of the stories I like, a lot of the films I like, and I imagine you too, have to do with a personal encounter between two people or groups of people. And the ones that are really moving are ones that involve some kind of distance that's been traveled, ones in which people have overcome lots of obstacles or adversity to be together, ones that were a surprise, somebody wasn't expecting it. Sometimes it is the case that someone just, it's a great display of humility to be with someone in a certain way. All the stories and films that you hear, that you like, that move you, probably involve those kinds of dynamics. I like to think this is how me and Debbie's story began, with this kind of drama. Debbie and I met in spring of my freshman year in college, 2 weeks before spring break. We'd seen each other a couple of times, we've had a few conversations. We were pretty sure we might like the other one if the other one liked us. If we could confirm that, then we would like them for sure. So she went home to Dallas for spring break, and I came down to Austin, and I was going to go down to the coast with some friends, and I was just super antsy. I just could not stop thinking about her. And so in the middle of the night, my first night in Austin, we're to leave the next morning. I can't sleep. I'm thinking about Debbie, and I'm like, I've got to go find her. I knew she lived in Dallas. I didn't have her phone number. I didn't have any of that kind of information yet. So I just get in my car. I don't tell anybody I'm leaving. I drive to my house, which is near Fort Worth, because that's getting closer. And the next day, I begin to hatch a plan. How am I going to find her? There's only a few people in Dallas. So I call my roommate, because I know that he's friends with one of her friends. And I say, hey, do you have that girl's phone number? Because I bet she has Debbie's phone number. And sure enough, she did. And so we tracked her down. I gave her a call. I asked her on a date. And then I went and got her. All right, that's my version of the story. And Debbie's not here, so you know what? Fair representation. I'll give you her version. Debbie's version of the story is there was this strange boy that I met, and we didn't have plans, but he decided to call me, and he asked me on a date, and that was fine. And what she came to find out later was that I didn't have any money, and so I'd asked her to a concert, but I didn't have any money to buy the tickets for the concert. So in a moment of like bad judgment, I decided, my parents have money, I'll ask them to come to the concert. Why wouldn't I just ask them for money? I don't know. So, and my parents are like, yeah, that sounds great. So Debbie's version of the story is, this strange boy that I met a couple weeks ago came and picked me up for a date with his parents in his dad's company car. And we went to a concert, and then they dropped me off, and then they all went home. All right. So my version is like the Last of the Mohicans, you know, I will find you. Debbie's version is like a junior high flashback kind of thing. So for the purposes of this sermon, we're going to go with my version. Because in our text today, we have a very dramatic and very famous event, a very famous encounter. It is God coming to Moses in the burning bush. It's more like Last of the Mohicans and less like junior high. We've been saying that Exodus has basically two levels of meaning. The first level of meaning is just that it is a true account of history. It's what God did to bring the nation of Israel out of slavery in Egypt and into the promised land. And then second, it has another level of meaning because it's also, the whole Exodus story is a paradigm of salvation and how it works. It's a picture of how God saves us, delivers us out of slavery to sin, and brings us into new life with him. And so as we look at this story, we want to understand and appreciate what God is doing with Moses. But we also want to see that this is what God is doing with us. I think deep down we all want, are desperate for, a personal encounter with God. If you're not a Christian, you may have been searching for God, you want to believe in him, but you just like, will he, how do I know he's really real? And you want some kind of encounter that affirms that. But even if you are a Christian, you know, you go through dry spells, hard times. And you need to know that what you know is true is felt experientially and personally. We all have a desperate need for an encounter with God. And when we read encounters like this, it brings that to the surface, and it's kind of a double-edged sword. It's like going to a really cool house. For a little while, you're like, oh, this is really cool. Like, it's awesome, like the way that's laid out. I love it. And then you start to realize, this is not mine, and it never will be. And then it's just sort of depressing after that. Sometimes that's what happens when you read stories in the Bible. You're like, yes, God is awesome. And then you feel the discrepancy deep of like, man, I've never experienced God like that. The feeling of God being absent or distant or silent is really common in the scriptures. The Psalms and the prophets cry out over and over, God, where are you? How long? When will you come through? Think of Israel. They've been enslaved. These are God's people. They've been enslaved in Egypt for 430 years. Where's God? Moses, as we come to him in this chapter today, has been in the wilderness for 40 years. Where's God? I think we all can identify with that sense of God being absent or silent. And Exodus 3 speaks into that silence really good news. And the good news is God comes to us. God comes to us. This is going to be a really simple sermon because one of the things we do in Christianity to numb the sense that we're not experiencing God is we make it really complex with lots of stuff and activities. And what I want to sink in today is that God mercifully, graciously, willingly comes to us. And Exodus 3 tells us a little bit about how God comes to us. Let's begin in verse 1. God comes to us where we are, in this case, the wilderness. Verse 1, now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Okay, so Moses is in the wilderness. What's he doing there? You'll remember from Exodus 1 and 2 that Israel's enslaved in Egypt. God begins to hatch a plan for deliverance, which begins with saving Moses from Pharaoh's edict that all Israelite male boys would be thrown into the Nile. God preserves Moses. He's already at work to bring redemption. Moses grows up in Pharaoh's house, first 40 years of his life. And it's probably a pretty complicated situation because he's culturally Egyptian, but he's ethnically, he's by blood, he's Israelite. I wonder if Moses thought someday maybe he would be able to use his privilege as an Egyptian to save his Israelite brethren. Maybe that's why one day, the text says, he decided to go out and look upon the burden of his people. And when he went out there, what he saw was an Egyptian beating an Israelite. And he just snapped. He just couldn't handle it. And he struck the Israelite down, dead, and buried him in the sand. And when Pharaoh heard of this, he sought to kill Moses. And so Moses fled. He got out of there, and he ended up in a place called Midian, which is like probably 200 or 300 miles away in the wilderness, so to speak. So Moses flees, and he's a fugitive now. All the hopes he had of maybe helping his people, gone. All the comforts he had of living in Egypt, gone. Everything has gone wrong in Moses' life, and that's why he's in the wilderness. Well, while he's there, he meets a woman named Zipporah. He takes a job with her father-in-law, tending his sheep. They have a few kids, and he just sort of settles down there and kind of eases into as normal a life as he could have. And that's where we pick up in chapter 3. Moses is keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro. And he led his flock on this day to the west side of the wilderness, and he came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him, verse 2, in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And so Moses is telling us where he was and what he was doing when God came to him. He was in the wilderness, but on the west side of the wilderness, which is to say just way out there. And I think that the details are given to emphasize his status of waywardness. This is not just where Moses is geographically. This is where Moses is spiritually. Far from home, far from God. The wilderness, or the desert, is mentioned a lot in the scriptures. You got guys like Abraham and the nation of Israel and David and John the Baptist, Jesus, even all these guys spent time in the wilderness. Sometimes the wilderness is a place of testing or trial. Sometimes it's a place of danger or persecution. But usually, for whatever reason God's people are in the wilderness, usually it is, from God's perspective, a means of forming them, of growing them up, of maturing them, of helping them get a deep awareness and sense of their need for God. You know, the Bible at one point describes Moses as the meekest man on earth. Wait, you're talking about the same guy that snapped on that Egyptian dude and just struck him down? That guy? So how does he go from being murderer to the meekest person on earth? Well, I imagine he learned some of that in the wilderness. Now, from Moses' perspective, it seems like God has been distant and silent for these 40 years, or 80 years maybe. But absence and silence is one of the ways God trains his people. I don't know all that happened in Moses' life during his time in Midian, but it seems like God was absent. Of course, he wasn't truly absent, because God had been working in Moses' life since his birth. But from Moses' perspective, we all know what it's like to know that God is real and out there, yet have a sense or a lack of a sense of his presence in our life in a daily basis, right? And so you may believe, no, God's not absent. He's with us, because that's what Jesus said. But I'm talking about functionally, experientially, your sense that God might not, isn't sort of vital in your day-to-day. God is not unaware. He's going to tell Moses later on in this text. Look in verse 7. The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I've come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And so God is not absent. He's not unaware. He hears, he knows, he sees, he comes down. And so wherever you may be, whatever your wilderness is, and however you got there, God comes to us. And you know why? I just find this interesting. You know, Jesus went into the wilderness, and it wasn't God that came to him. It was Satan that came to him. And in the wilderness, Jesus endured temptation and trial and endured it righteously, came through it righteously in our place, because we would have failed that. We have failed that. And so part of what it means that God comes down to deliver us is that he comes down in his Son, who is righteous in our place, and his righteousness, his life, is credited to us as if we had lived righteously. Jesus goes into the wilderness and Satan comes to him so that God can come to us. It's good news. So God comes to us where we are, but not necessarily on our terms. Look at verse 3. Moses looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sight. Why would you have to say that to yourself? You would just do it, right? You would just turn aside and see it, but here it is. Why the bush is not burned. So have you ever read this and just wondered, why does God come like this? This is a strange kind of way to appear to someone. Well, I think on one hand, it's common. Bushes caught fire in the wilderness all the time. And so there's something here to be learned about, just that God comes to us in the ordinary things. But on the other hand, this isn't common at all. You know, because bushes that caught fire burned up. But look what happens here. Moses looked, and behold, the bush was burning, okay? No big deal, happens all the time. Yet, it was not consumed. Now, that never happens. It always gets consumed. It's perplexing. It's hard to account for. This is how God comes to us. Not on our terms, but always, almost always, I should say, disruptively. When God comes into your life, it disrupts your normal flow of things. Moses is having a normal day. He's not looking for God necessarily. He's just going about his business. Can't you relate to that? I mean, I know that you believe in God, but can't you just relate to the reality of just going about your work or your life, not necessarily expecting or looking for God to show up in some way? I mean, don't we make plans and just do them without considering what are God's plans for today? I do that all the time. I just do my normal life. You see, normal life is its own kind of wilderness, I think. Geographical wilderness is easy to spot. It's like outside of town. People don't live there. Spiritual wilderness is much more subtle. It's less obvious. We enter into spiritual wilderness sometimes just by entering into our normal days without even knowing it. I think the enemy's goal is not necessarily just to derail your life. I mean, I think he would love to do that. But I think he also knows that for most of us, if our life were to be derailed, actually what that would do is point us to God and we would pursue him more ardently. I think the strategy of the enemy, at least in our culture, is just to lull us in a normal, good life, a life that doesn't need God. Believing in God is fine. The demons believe in God. It's different for God to be fire to you. So when God comes to us, he comes disruptively. He gets our attention by doing things that don't make sense, things that don't fit our way of thinking, things that challenge our way of living and thinking about life. It could be a dramatic event. I mean, I had a friend who was in some financial trouble and had, just through discipline and work, worked his way out of it, paid off all his debt. His family was doing well. He bought a new house. And just like finally he felt in control, like, okay, I've got it. And then he had a stroke. He's my age. And just like that, every way he was thinking about life and what it meant to have a good life and what it meant to be in control was gone. Got his attention, scared him to death, almost literally. It doesn't have to be dramatic, though. There's all kinds of little burning bushes out there. Just a beautiful sunset, a story that moves you. Anything that moves you is a burning bush. I think it's God's way of getting your attention, and you should ask the question, why is that moving to me? What well is that tapping deep down in my soul that I need to pay attention to? Good things can be burning bushes. You know, one of the most disruptive things that I do every day is read the Bible. Because every time I read it, it's not about me, and that disrupts my normal way of thinking about my life. Whenever I'm in community, being honest, other people being honest with me, it's almost always disruptive. Because I have other things that I want to do, I've got places I want to be, I don't want to spend the energy, the emotional energy it takes to have real relationships with people, always disruptive to have real relationships. Whenever I know God's calling me to something, to serve someone in some way, to talk about him with my neighbors, always disruptive. Always not what I want to do in the moment. And so even good things, the very basic things, the DNA of our church are disruptive things. And so if you feel like you're in a place with God sometimes where he's just like perplexing, maybe even irritating, that's probably a good sign that God's showing up in your life, trying to disrupt things. I want you to think about the people, the situations in your life that are hard and that are confusing, things that you might want to give up on, that you're angry about, and just ask the question, is it possible that God is in those things, asking you to turn aside and see him? Because if God is in those things and you turn aside and see, you'll realize that God comes to us personally. Look at verse 4. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. Now Moses said, here I am. This is nuts. No God for at least 40 years, and now there's a burning bush, and that's strange. I will go over there and see what's going on in there. And then the voice of God comes out, and it's not just the voice of God. He's saying, your name, Moses, Moses. In Hebrew, the doubling of a name intensifies the emotion of it. It's a name of, it's a literary device to emphasize intimacy and relationship. God is not just saying Moses' name, he's calling out to Moses. And isn't that what you want? Not just to know that God knows who you are and where you are, but to hear him in some way call out to you, to know you intimately. We know things about God. We have doctrine. A personal encounter, though, is something that makes our doctrine dance. It is to experience God in some way where what we know comes alive. It fans into flame the emotions and the affections we have for Jesus. And I think that's what we want. God's going to tell Moses in a second his name, or who he is, that he's the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. But before we get there, he says, Moses, Moses. Before we get there, he's the God of Moses. And some of you need to hear that the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses is also your God. He's our God. I was reading Isaiah this week just in my Bible reading plan, and Isaiah 43, God says, "Don't fear. I've called you by name. You're mine." I needed to hear that day that I read it. You need to hear it now. Have you ever experienced God in some way that was really moving, but would be difficult or maybe even embarrassing to share with someone else? Because, you know, like for you, like you understood how he was speaking to you very uniquely and into the context of your situation, and it was moving. But when you try to explain to somebody else, like it doesn't make any sense, and they're like, okay, that's good. Good for you. That's great. Have you ever had that? I have this all the time. So when we were trying to decide if we were going to move to Austin and start this church, there were a number of things that God did to affirm that in us. But there was this one night where this thing happened. I'm not going to tell you because it's embarrassing. But here's why I wouldn't tell you. Because for me, it was incredibly powerful. Like, I can see it in my mind. I remember how I felt. And I've tried to share it with people, and I get that response. Like, what? That's kind of cheesy. So here's why I'm saying that. Because I think that this is evidence of the way that God comes to us personally. God comes to us in such unique ways, speaks to us in such unique ways and with reference to our specific situations that it's so intimate and it's so powerful for us, but it's so unique that it doesn't even really translate when you try to share it with somebody else. If it translated to everybody, then it would be hard to say that God came to me personally in some way. And so if you've had that experience where you felt like cheesy in some way with God, that's probably evidence that God has come to you, that he's speaking to you. It's not always evidence. Some of you are just cheesy and sentimental. That's why you have elders. We'll tell you when you're being like that. So God comes to us personally. He speaks to us uniquely, but on his terms. Verse 5, then God said, "Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you're standing is holy ground." And so God calls out to Moses, "Moses, Moses." Moses begins to move toward him, and God says, "Stop! Don't come any closer. Take your shoes off, man. Don't you know where you are?" God's personal. God wants a relationship with us, but he's still God. He's holy. That's the reason the ground is holy, because God is there. This is actually the first time in the scriptures, I think, that the word holy is used. It's not an attribute of God, like God is love or God is just. Holiness is more about the essence of God. It's like a synonym for deity. To say that God is holy is to say that God is God. He's other. He's separate. He's transcendent. He's not like us. And so God is separating him and Moses. He's conveying something about the gap that exists between the divine and the human. Moses, stop. I think this is why the imagery of fire is so cool here. Because fire, you know, depends, like if a bush is burning, the fire depends on the bush to fuel the flame. And when there's no more bush, then the fire goes out. But this fire keeps burning and the bush never burns up. This fire is not dependent on anything. It's internally fueled in some way. And God is communicating in the fire that he is eternally self-sufficient without beginning or end. He doesn't depend on anything or anyone. In fact, everything and everyone depends on him. That's what it means that God is holy. And when God tells Moses that his name is I Am, you know, Moses says, what's your name? And God says, I Am. I am who I am. It's his way of saying, don't you worry about my name yet. I am. You need to know what I'm like. I am the fire that just never burns out. Tim Keller says, people believe in God, but he's not fire to them. Fire means that God's become a spiritual reality to you. And he points out that it's interesting that God doesn't come as water, because water is something you can touch. You can manipulate it in some way. Like clay, you can form it. You touch fire, it forms you. You're consumed by it. That's what God's trying to convey. I'm not the kind of God that you can create or mold or shape or coerce or manipulate. I am who I am. I am holy. In consumer capitalism, which is our world, we choose everything. We customize everything. And this is how people talk about God. I mean, when I talk to my neighbors about God, they love to say things like, well, I like to think of God as like, and just whatever comes after that doesn't matter because they have the wrong starting point. Like if I came to you and said, hey, I'd like to get to know you, and I like to think of you as a very stubborn, sort of irritating person. Would you be like, whoa, you don't even know, how you can't say that I'm like that because you don't know me. Well, that's what it's like for people to say, I like to think of God as, you know, God is saying, no, I am who I am, not who you want me to be. God does not say, I'm the God of your imagination. He says, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face. He was afraid to look at God. How do you know that God's come to you? How do you know you're in the presence of the holy God? It scares you. You feel like you should probably look away. You feel unworthy in some way. It's tragic because we were made to gaze upon the glory of God. Like Adam walked with God in the cool of the day in the garden. But because we fell into sin, we can no longer look upon the glory of God. Anyone who looks and sees God dies. And so how is it that God has come to Moses? How is it that God comes to us? Well, he comes through a mediator. I didn't see this, but here it is in verse 2. Notice this. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. That's verse 2. But in verse 4, who's talking? God called out to Moses, Moses, Moses. Well, so is it the angel of the Lord or is it God that's in the bush? That's kind of a tricky one, isn't it? Fitting, because it's a burning bush. Well, in the Bible, there's angels, Gabriel and whatnot, angels. But there's one, the angel of the Lord. And the angel of the Lord is, well, it's God himself in some way, but it's a mediated God. Let me put it this way. Had Moses come closer to the bush, I think he would have died, for sure. It was holy ground. That was a gracious thing for God to say stop, because God wants to know him, and so he wants him to be alive. And it would just melt Moses' face off to get any closer. But the only reason Moses isn't dead already is because God is appearing to him in a mediated fashion. Here's what Motier says, a commentator on this passage. The angel of the Lord shows up in scriptures when God wants to draw near to someone without destroying them. He is the merciful accommodation of God, whereby the holy God can be with sinners without destroying them. Who can that be? He asks. Because there's only one other like that. The angel of the Lord can only be understood as a pre-incarnate Christ. I don't want to get all geeky on you here, but in the Old Testament, there are times when God appears, and it is, in fact, the pre-incarnate Son of God, Christ. And so when you get to John 8, and they're asking him about his identity, and Jesus says, let me tell you something. Before Abraham was, I am. That's what he's saying. He's saying, I am who I am. Jesus is saying, I am God. And so, I am is in the bush. The mediator. Paul says there's only one God and one mediator between God and man, Christ Jesus, who died as a ransom for all. When Jesus went to the cross, it was, I am on the cross. The Holy One. The eternal flame hanging on the tree. He stood in our place. He died the death that we deserve to die because of God, because of our sin. On the cross, Jesus cried out, just like Israel cried out, my God, where are you? Why have you forsaken me? Silence. God was absent. And the Son was consumed. It seemed that the fire had gone out. But 3 days later, Jesus was raised from the dead. He ascended into heaven. He sat down where he now reigns at the right hand of the throne of God. You know what he's doing there? Interceding for us. He is the mediator of the new covenant. One mediator between God and man, Jesus. If you want to have an encounter with God, look to Jesus. God has come to us in his Son, Jesus. God still comes to us in his word and by his spirit and through his people. But all of that is mediated by Jesus. And the purpose of all of that is not that we get warm fuzzies, but that our affections would be stirred and our love would be kindled for Jesus. That's the point of communion, which we're going to take here in just a moment. Communion is a reminder that God has come to us in his Son, Jesus. But it's also an invitation for you to come and to encounter God. To take the bread, which Jesus held up with his friends, and he said, this is my body broken for you. He says, when you eat of this, do so in remembrance of me. Know that I am there with you. And he held up the cup, and he said, this is a cup of the new covenant, which I am the mediator. My blood shed for the forgiveness of sins. And when you drink of this, do so in remembrance of me, knowing that I'm with you. When we take this meal, we're not just eating and drinking. We're eating and drinking with God in his presence, receiving the nourishment of his grace. Let's pray and thank God for this.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.